You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Chen.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for showing up. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. Obviously, people should rate and review. We needn't dwell on that. Let me introduce you, though. Your name is Chen Yu Fang. You are, among other things, pursuing a PhD at Harvard right now in the history of science. You've spent a little time in the think tank world. You were a technology and democracy fellow at New America. I was a fellow at New America, by the way, so long ago that it was then called the New America Foundation, but I guess they streamlined the brand. And you write stuff. You recently wrote a piece called Silicon Valley Goes to War in a magazine, a website that may be pronounced Noema. I don't think either of us is sure. It's N-O-E-M-A. It's a very interesting site. I've always been intrigued by it. It's kind of offbeat, philosophical. It does interesting stuff, but I have no idea how to pronounce its name. So I want to, you know, before this is over, I hope we'll talk about that piece about the Silicon Valley, military industrial complex or whatever, and about some of the stuff you're studying in pursuit of your PhD. But I wanted to start out on the subject of China pretty broadly. I think I heard you say on a podcast once that you sometimes felt as if your job was explaining China, by which I think you mean, I took you to mean that, you know, because you spent, I think, the first 14 years of your life in China before coming here, and you stay in touch, you know something about China, and people are curious, and they ask questions. I'm sure some of them are good, and some of them seem naive, but, you know, we're at a time where I think perceptions of China are particularly important. U.S.-China relations are important for the whole world. I think AI makes that only truer. And, you know, since perceptions of countries shape policies toward them, I thought it would be good to try to get a clear sense of what's going on in China, what it's like in China, what it's like to live in China. Because one thing, you know, to put a slightly finer point on this, in the world of AI, or the discourse about AI, you hear a lot of people say we have to win this AI race with China. One common rationale is that if we don't, then China will have power such that they can impose their system of government and way of life on the rest of the world, including us. Now, that assumes that China wants to do that. I'm not sure about that. But it also assumes that things are pretty bad in China. I mean, I guess if you think there's this kind of life or death struggle to keep your country from becoming like another country, you know, you must have a fairly dark view of what life's like in the other country. And honestly, I don't think I have a super clear view, and I'm hoping to ask you questions that clear things up. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just to clarify, I haven't been in China in 10, 11 months, and I'm actually going to China in a few weeks to really get a sense of what's going on right now. So my knowledge of all of this might be out of date since things move so fast in both AI in China and here in America as well. I think one thing that's really important to know in that sort of narrative, which I hear so often these days, is that what is going on in China and what China wants for the world, I think are rather two separate things, right? I think there's a lot of mirror imaging going on in the United States where, because, you know, the United States is a power that really cares about projecting its power abroad, that we want other people to live like Americans. You know, growing up as a kid in China, like, there was a sense of truth to that, right? That, like, people were watching American films, reading American literature, and in the United States, there's this general sense of, oh, if everybody becomes more like America, the world would be a better place, or they'll be more friendly to Americans. Kaiser Guo, the host of the Seneca podcast, mm-hmm. Has this famous line.
Who is moving to China, by the way.
Oh, yes. That's what I heard, too.
I talked to him yesterday, but go ahead.
Oh, wonderful. He has this famous line where Chinese exceptionalism and American exceptionalism are two different types, right? In the U.S., American exceptionalism means that everybody should be like Americans. We have the best values, we have the best mm-hmm. cultures, and everybody else should be more like the U.S. Chinese exceptionalism is more like, nobody can replicate the Chinese success.
Right.
So it has to be Chinese. And you can say both versions of these are bad, maybe one is worse than the other. But I'm trying to take it as a case of, what China wants for China and what China wants for the rest of the world are rather two, different things. Mm-hmm. From a foreign policy perspective, China cares a lot about what Taiwan does. The PRC deems Taiwan its own territory. We can talk a lot about that. It cares a lot about what Hong Kong does. It cares a lot about what Tibet does. But I guess it cares much less about what Americans do in their own country. It cares less about what Canadians or British people do in their own country, as long as they don't relate directly to China, right? So I think it's important to separate these two worlds that people talk about.
And this is the Chinese government you're talking about, basically. In other words, you're saying, as a matter of policy, this is what they do and don't focus on.
That's my understanding of what their priorities are. Mm-hmm. I have never heard of any prominent Chinese politician or ideologue or even commentator saying that the U.S. should no longer be a democracy and should adopt the China model. Mm-hmm. I think if you propose that in China, that would be a ridiculous claim and people will laugh at you. Mm-hmm. That I think that's a slightly different mode of thinking or mode of political philosophy than what we herald here in the U.S.
Okay. I mean, I think, countries try to exert influence. Powerful countries try to exert more. And I think China does, too. I think the confusion in America is, what kind of influence they want and how that is and isn't different from the way we pursue influence. But let me try to get a clearer sense. Now, I know you left there when you were 14, but you go back and you've stayed in touch and you're very much a citizen of the online world. And so I think you have a
unfortunately.
Much, yeah, well, for better or worse for all of us. You have a much clearer idea than I do of what that's like. Obviously a big issue for Americans is freedom of speech. I mean, I think if you ask these people who say we must win the AI race lest we, get swallowed up or something, they would bring that up almost right away. And, I'm sure there are constraints on speech that there aren't here. Now, there may be certain kinds of normative constraints here that aren't there. I don't know. But why don't we start off by talking about, for example, if you're online, what constraints would you feel? What kinds of things are you not supposed to say explicitly? And what kind of trouble would you get into if you did?
I mean, I think that the tough thing about this is that the lines are so blurry, mm-hmm. blurry all the time, right? So there are obviously the things, there's obviously the most overt version of censorship, which is if you're going on Weibo, right? Something like Twitter or Facebook, mm-hmm. the equivalent of that in China. You can't talk about taking down the government. Right, you can't talk about starting a revolution.
If you talk about that in certain ways in the U.S., you will find yourself in trouble.
I mean, if you do that in the U.S. and the U.K., there are right. versions of that leads to problems too. But obviously, sort of the Chinese censorship regime is much more visible, and people are hyper aware of it, for better or worse.
Well, what is there an example? I mean, the most famous thing, of course, is Tiananmen Square.
Sure.
Apparently, you're not supposed to refer to the famous incident in which I think hundreds were killed or something. I remember the film. I remember the video at the time of the tanks going into the crowd and crushing people. I gather you're not supposed to A, is it true that you're not supposed to make reference to that? And second, if that is true, what else is in that category? I mean, in other words, as you said, the lines are blurry, so maybe a lot of these questions are hard to answer, but that would be a clear-cut case if it's something you're not supposed to talk about. And I guess, is that such a case, A? And B, are there other such cases?
It's you're not supposed to make direct references to it. And then your post gets censored, your account gets deleted possibly. I think just mentioning it would not get you a knock on the door. But if you organized an entire memorial around it, that would have been a problem. The censorship exists, but then that doesn't necessarily preclude people from talking about it in one way or another.
I mean, does everyone know about it?
I mean, I guess not everybody, right? You don't see this in history books necessarily. You don't see
but
this.
Did you know about it at age before you came over?
Yeah, absolutely. Online. I was very online.
So it gets referred to in the end online, regardless, in some way or another.
Regardless, your family talks about it. Some people, I mean, it's a complex historical event, right? People were traumatized by it. You know, I think there's some truth to people talking about how older generations don't want to talk about it because of censorship. But it's also true that, you know, thinking about my parents' generation, people who are older than me, they were there themselves to say that they didn't know about this.
Right.
That would have been ridiculous, right? There's a reason they don't talk about this sort of stuff on the internet. Part of that censorship, part of it is just like they don't feel like talking about it. It is, if you think about the longer historiography of, say, Tiananmen itself, right? To live in China today and to enjoy all the economic success it's had, you would have to reckon with the humanitarian disaster and the atrocity that happened in 1989. And a lot of people are simply unwilling to reflect it. But going back to the topic of censorship, Tiananmen, obviously, you have, like, you can't talk about Tibetan independence, you can't talk about Taiwanese independence, you have all these things that are fall under the realm of clear red lines. You also have things that are
just
more
to be
dynamic.
Clear, you can't even talk about Taiwan independence, or you can't advocate it.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about how the Taiwanese independence activists are bad, right? you can advocate against Taiwanese independence, and that is the context in which you could talk about it. But it's a tricky thing, and the lines change every day. There are sometimes current affairs and current events that are that the government deems sensitive. And it might be sensitive today, might not be sensitive in 2 years. And something that might not have been sensitive 2 years ago might be sensitive today. And it's a very complex system. My friend Elin Liu has recently written a book called The Wall Dancers. And she uses this term wall dancing as a metaphor to being an online person in China. It's like you're always navigating around these boundaries. But you're still dancing.
Right. In other words, people, at least some people, they find a way to refer to things online in a way that other people understand. Sometimes they're like code words and things, in effect. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. So one example I think is it's a pre-widespread is people were referring to the Me Too movement in China because almost nationwide Me Too movement in China as well. And clearly, that implicated people who are in higher positions of power, and the government didn't want people to be talking about it. So, a lot of activists were using the rice emoji and the rabbit emoji because it stands for Me Too, as a homophone for Me Too movement.
You mean like the English phrase
right. So it's rice rabbit, which is Me Too in Chinese. which sounds like Me Too. So people were using these ways to get around censorship and forge these discussions in smaller subcultural communities and on a if you know you know basis. I don't think. I mean, once these get publicized, they don't work anymore. But it's very much a cat and mouse race.
Mm-hmm. And I guess if you started saying, you know, we need a fundamentally different kind of government here, she should be subject to popular election, every, you know, whatever, you would get into trouble?
Yeah, I think very much so.
Mm-hmm. And to what, I mean, do people find this problematic? I mean, I guess it exerts a genuine constraint on speech, since the online world is the you know, the main or a primary venue for exchanging ideas, right? But so is there a sense that, you know, I think Americans sometimes, well, of course, the discourse about China happens among a subset of Americans mainly, right? People who are, you know, pretty well educated, people who live in the world of ideas, people who make a living kind of expressing ideas. And so, for example, with Iran, I thought there was a certain amount of misinterpretation of the second round in demonstrations where thousands of people were killed. You know, as I understand it, that was just fundamentally about economics. But, you know, a number of Americans, I think, thought it was like they're demonstrating for free speech. Well, they'd like to be allowed to demonstrate, but what they're demonstrating about is food. And so I think sometimes people here overestimate the extent to which a constraint in that realm is felt, if that makes sense. I mean, I think you're totally correct. Yeah, go ahead.
I think you're totally correct. The problem with intellectuals is that we like to flatter ourselves and think that our priorities are everybody else's priorities. That happens, you know, in China too. You have a very large class of journalists, intellectuals, university professors who are very angry about these online censorships. And a lot of the criticism are entirely correct. You can, you know, having censorship on speech hinders various sorts of civil societies and organizations and social movements. But setting that aside, most people in China aren't thinking about it, right? Most people in China, I mean, most Americans don't think about politics online. Right. I think these are real problems, but they only pertain to a much smaller group of people. I like there to be freer journalism in China. I like there to be freer speech in China. But these are also not the concerns of the majority of people. And when they are angry, they're angry about, you know, economic issues. They're worried about their social welfare. They're mm-hmm. worried about employment. We're worried about, you know, other forms of injustices.
Yeah. How much support for the government do you sense? I mean, that's another idea you hear in America is like once a country is thought of as authoritarian, the assumption is, well, it's kind of as a corollary of what I just said. The assumption is everyone is chafing under control and they don't support the government. But I gather there is a fair amount of what from America would look like nationalism and what in China would be more like patriotism, I guess, but a fair amount of pride in the country that does at the moment translate into support for the government. Is that true? I mean, I don't know.
The better question is to not buy into that authoritarianism, democracy binary and ask the question, what part of the government are you supporting, right? If you're asking whether people in China are willing to subvert the CCP and replace it with a democratic elected government, the question is, one, what democratic elected government? There doesn't seem to be an alternative just yet. And two, you know, the CCP has been pretty successful in its in its administration since at least the late 1970s, delivering the economic growth and changed many people's lives. And for all they know, their lives were better than their parents' lives, and their parents' lives were better than their grandparents' lives. That fosters some sort of support for the regime, for the Chinese mm-hmm. government. But then there's also the question of, you know, do they support this particular things that the Chinese Communist Party does? Do they support the current leadership? Do they support the ways that specific things are organized? That becomes much trickier. And then there's also the question of, do they support the U.S. The U.S. government come in and say, we're going to kneecap Chinese technology and Chinese economic growth? I think these are all very different questions, and you will hear very different answers in the PRC. I think it's a very complex question.
Mm-hmm. And is there much awareness of the fact that she has, I guess, altered the norms and or laws governing the succession of power? Such that, I mean, he has concentrated power relative to his predecessors, right? And is staying in office longer than had been either the norm or the law. I don't know. Is there much? I mean, let's just confine it to the kinds of intellectuals who think about these things in China. Is there much concern about that or dissatisfaction with it, so far as you can tell?
Yeah, I mean, in 2018, it was very controversial. People thought it was a really a step backwards from the kinds of institutions, rules, norms, what have you, since the Deng era, and a lot of intellectuals, liberal intellectuals especially, were worried that this would be a return to the Mao era. I think there were legitimate concerns about it. I think those are still reasons that many intellectuals are dissatisfied with the current regime. Mm-hmm. The current government right now.
Now, I gather in some respects, the Chinese government, and I don't really know if I'm talking more about the federal government or the provincial governments, but is quite responsive to certain kinds of expressed popular discontent, right? I mean, there are certain kinds of grievances that get expressed by people. And the government, it seems to me, from what I hear, is it sometimes more immediately attentive to them than you might see even in the United States in some cases. Does that sound right? Now, I'm not sure I've seen reports of this so recently, but I recall being struck, like, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, by, like, if there was, like, an environmental problem, there was, like, pollution in a pond in some rural area, and people would start complaining about it. And when cell phones were new, they were using cell phones, I think, as a tool of organization. And they would have like demonstrations or something, and it would really get the attention of the government. Is there robust feedback at that level that leads to the government attending to the popular concerns?
I mean, I think the actual performance is quite varied based on where you are. Mm-hmm. Obviously, bigger cities have better, you know, what you call state capacity, I guess. That, you know, if you're in Beijing or Shanghai and your pothole is broken, somebody's gonna fix it. If you're angry, if you're staging a mass demonstration, chances are the problem gets fixed while you're getting cracked down on. There is that sense of accountability, and in many ways, that sense of accountability is much more accountable than what we have here in the U.S. In some cases, right? But then there is also the question of, do the structural problems get fixed? Or do they not? Right, you might have one bad leader the CCP is very much the CCP is very heavy-handed around government performance. So if you're the leader of a district, if you're mm-hmm. a leader of a city, and there is a big demonstration going on in your city because you've mistreated some of the residents, chances are that's not going to look good on your resume, and that has career implications in a way that there doesn't seem to be as much in our elected democracy. Mm-hmm. But then the question is like, well, the next person is going to come up. What if that person also does a bad job? Mm-hmm. The structural problems get that's trickier, I would mm-hmm. say.
I get the sense that in some ways, differences among different governing districts matter in some ways more there than they do here in the United States. I mean, apparently, didn't they just announce some reform that's going to make it easier for workers to people to travel to another part of China to work without losing the, for example, health insurance that they had enjoyed in the previous place that was government provided. Is that true?
So I think you're referring to the most recent Hukou reforms. I think it's mm-hmm. still in proposal phase.
Okay.
But this is sort of one of the subjects of both Chinese and Western critics in the last 20, 30 years, which is after the economic reform in the 1970s and 80s, people were migrating to other parts of the country, right? That you're from the countryside, you move to Beijing, you move to Shanghai. And the problem with that is there is this socialist legacy of household registrations. You might live in Beijing, you might have migrated there, you might have kids there, you might have lived there for 20 years. Your household registration still in your hometown, and there was no way to move it to the city. And the problem with that is primarily because household registration is linked to social security, welfare, housing, healthcare, et cetera.
Right.
And I think in the last 10, 15 years, the Hukou rules have been liberalizing. It was very hard to get a Hukou in the city if you're from a rural area 10, 15 years ago, and now it's much easier. Mm-hmm. It is still very restrictive in the big metropolises, but for the provincial capitals, it's much, has recently eased quite a lot to just because poverty of alleviation and urbanization happening much faster than that elsewhere.
You alluded to views of America in China and the perception that the U.S. is trying to kneecap China with, export controls on microchips, for example. What is the how widespread is that sense? What is the view of the U.S. like? And also, how well does information about the U.S. and the rest of the world get into China? In other words, is the view of America and other countries, about as clear as America's view and of other countries, just in terms of the news that gets in about what's actually happening?
Well, I think news about America are very much wide open in China, right? The people have access to. There's very little censorship about these U.S. U.S. actions on the PRC, mm-hmm. just because why would they censor it, right? It's perfect for portraying the sort of the quote unquote anti-China sentiments that happen here.
Well, but are there more flattering things about America that do get filtered out, or that the government tries to filter out?
Well, for one, I don't know if there's a lot of flattering news about the U.S. these days.
I know
the government. I mean, you see, in China, people are talking about how Americans are visiting China again, right? People from the Western world are visiting China after COVID again, the China maxing trends get reported quite a lot.
What does China maxing mean?
I guess mostly people online talking about how they're now in a very Chinese time of their lives. And there's a lot of American fascination with China, part because of American.
You mean Chinese people say they're in the Chinese part of our lives what?
No, sorry. Americans saying that they're in a Chinese time of their lives.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I think it's a very online meme, and people are talking about how they're now, they want to drive BYD electric vehicles.
There is a lot of dissatisfaction about the 100% tariff or whatever it is that's keeping those EVs out.
So there's a lot of positive reporting about America because Americans apparently love China now, more so than maybe a year ago.
I see. So the news that that Americans like certain Chinese products, for example, is favorable publicity in a way that in a sense warms Chinese people toward Americans, or
yeah, I suppose so.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but the kneecapping. I mean, there are a number of kind of policies that the U.S. does that I'm sure are considered hostile there are sanctions. There were sanctions about various things, human rights things, the Uyghurs. There are these tech restrictions. Is your sense that, as a rule, those tend to not, the Chinese people are just, that these things darken the Chinese view of Americans, I mean, of America? Or are there some that are better received than others? Like, are there some sanctions that some Chinese think are in order, or what?
I mean, I think one way to think about it is the CCP for a very long time, in the 2000s, early 2010s, had been saying that the U.S. was trying to kneecap Chinese economic development, technological development. And the liberals were saying, no, this is not the case. What the U.S. really cares about is liberal democracy, right? Is that they want China to have a better political system. Mm-hmm. They want China to be freer, whatever that means. And they don't really want a kneecap. They want China to be economically better, not worse. I think in the last, well, ever since the trade war, right, the 2017 first Trump term, there has been a growing recognition that the liberals were wrong and the CCP was right, or not the CCP per se. In the sense that. The true reason behind a lot of these export controls and sanctions and trade war behaviors were not necessarily about ideology and democratic institutions and these fancy moral terms. It was really just about great power competition. Mm-hmm. And I think not to generalize people in China, but a lot of people have seen that coming for a very long time. They're treating these actions as they are, which is great power competition as opposed to mm-hmm. moralistic human rights, liberal democracy talks mm-hmm. that we've seen for quite a long time, even especially under the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. Now you hear about the so-called century of humiliation as a big thing in Chinese psychology, right? Like Western powers dominating China, going back to, you know, Britain and the U.S. at various times and so on. But I sense that what you're talking about now is actually a little different. I mean, I assume it would be a little different in the sense that now, if the U.S. is trying to kneecap China, it's out of a sense of threat. Right. It would be, in a certain sense, a tribute to China's power and potential if the U.S. is really going out of its way to kneecap China. Whereas 100 years ago, that wasn't the idea. The idea was more like, hey, we're this advanced society. You're nothing. And we're going to dominate you. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite ironic because in China, this is taken as something to celebrate that you see people in the Trump administration and on the tech right, talking about reindustrialization of reintroducing manufacturing to the United States, and some seem to prefer a much more authoritarian approach of politics, as seen in the Trump administration. A lot of people in China are seeing this as a triumph of their way of doing things. That the mm-hmm. U.S. was criticizing the PRC for subsidies, industrial policy, export control, not necessarily export controls, but like a forced joint, quote unquote, intellectual transfer, technology transfers, joint venture companies. These were all sort of the bad things that the Chinese were doing. And if you go back to the Economist or the Wall Street Journal sort of essays from 10, 15 years ago, and these were the people saying this was a terrible thing. They would never succeed with industrial policy. And now the opposite thing was happening, right? Is that the U.S., first of all, recognize that China actually did the things that they thought wasn't going to happen is now posing a threat to industries in the United States and Europe. And on the other hand, that some in America seem to be quite receptive to the idea that the U.S. should do the same thing. And there is a recognition that this race is not a race about ideologies or developmental models, but rather just between two powers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're too young to remember the Japanese version of this, but like in the late 80s, there was, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there was almost a terror of Japan's growing economic power. And the issue of industrial policy was prominent, and there were people saying, you know, it's working for them. Maybe we should try it. And it was working for them. I'm not sure the American system is well suited to it, but it's like we've kind of been through this once. Now, of course, China, in terms of just sheer numbers, has more potential. So the story could turn out very differently. You know, in a certain sense, the Japanese, quote, threat just kind of faded a little. You got demographic issues kicked in, birth rate dropped, and for various reasons, I guess it came to seem like less of a threat. I mean, China, in terms of sheer magnitude, seems to me almost more inherently formidable economically. But there are these demographic issues there too, right? Birth rate issues. Of course, China did this thing. Now, let's talk a little about cultural differences because, so the one-child policy, and you're too young to remember the birth of, I mean, pardon the expression, but the birth of the one-child policy. And I remember when they instituted it, I thought, man, this is a radical experiment because like, first of all, if everyone's an only child, who knows what the, you know, growing up an only child is a different experience. Who knows what does that reduce the diversity of personalities and stuff? Plus, it's like, in theory, now, of course, it was never enforced so strictly everywhere that you did wind up with this simple version of it. But, you know, you're talking no cousins, two generations down, zero cousins. I just thought, you know, and I thought there's no way this would fly in the U.S. I mean, there would just be mass revolt if the government brought something like this up. So for starters, what would you say about that? Is this the kind of thing that, you know, there are these, I don't know whether you want to call them stereotypes or what, about in some Asian cultures, there being more of a kind of a willingness to sacrifice for society, I guess you could say, for the public good. I mean, just things like wearing, even before COVID, and I guess Japan in particular, you know, people would wear masks when they had a cold, right? Like, that's just a strictly selfless thing to do. You're taking the trouble to keep people you don't even know from getting sick. You just didn't see that kind of thing in America. So I guess I'm asking, well, I do want to get a little further into the one-child policy and its implications, because for one thing, the demographic ramifications continue. But also, I'm sure you've been asked about this cultural question broadly, the different sensibilities of East and West or whatever.
Yeah, beyond the one-child policy issue, I think, when I first, so I'm the only child, and everybody I knew in China growing up was an only child. And as kids, we were referred to as the little emperors, right? Because we were first or second generation of people who were born only children. And our parents' generation had siblings. So there was this, you know, all of society, a sort of psychological crisis of people being worried that the kids are going to have it too good. Which I think in many ways was true, right? Like,
you are a spoiled brat. Is that what you're saying?
I was a spoiled brat. I could go to schools. I could, enjoy a lot more resources.
That was part of the idea, right? It was partly a modernization drive, you know?
I mean, it was very much influenced by Club of Rome, sort of the population bomb.
Sort of
population of cybernetics that was very popular in the United States as well in the 1960s and 70s. I mean, this is part of what I study, but the kinds of technocratic control and the long-termist calculations as a kind of political rationality, that was very much borrowed from places like MIT, Dave Forrester, who was a management scientist there. So I think it was very much an imported idea to begin with. But the cultural change was real, and I think now that the one-child policy has been sort of rolled back, and now you have the government telling people to have three kids, the reversal of that culture is just as difficult, right? Is that you look at people of my generation, I can't think of anyone who thinks it's a good idea to have three kids in China. It's the housing prices, education prices, sending kids to swimming classes. These are prohibitively more expensive than they used to be just because they were designed for a market where everybody had one child. And that's just, you know, to say somebody, a working middle-class person living in Beijing should afford a three-bedroom apartment, that's a very difficult thing. And having more kids, you know, you have to adjust to the expectation.
And what about the difference in cultural sensibility? I guess I'm kind of asking, when this policy came into effect, and I know you weren't around, but was it the case that there was a lot of not effective, you know, political resistance to it, but there was a lot of psychological chafing at the constraint being imposed? Do you have a sense for how much dissatisfaction there was with the policy?
I mean, I think the policy, for one, was implemented and enforced quite unevenly. The rural urban divide was quite significant, given that it affected people in rural areas way more than it did urban areas. And this is a period when urbanization hadn't achieved the level of what it is today. So I think that was quite uneven.
You're saying it was enforced more in the rural areas than in the urban?
No, it was so the policy affected rural areas more than the urban areas because people in the countryside had more kids.
Just because they needed kids for their economic model.
Right, and this is where sort of the infanticide of young girls was mostly happening in rural parts of the country.
Right. Because if you can only have one child and you want it to be a boy,
I couldn't really speak of what the zeitgeist was back then.
But, yeah. Okay. Well, listen, so we're at about 40 minutes. Normally, we go into overtime, which is the period of the conversation that is open to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes that lets you become one, or you can go to nonzero.org, find this post, and that's another way to become one and immediately access the rest of this conversation. And I want to talk about a number of things. I want to get into AI a little. It's almost hard to avoid. I do want to get into your Silicon Valley Goes to War piece and into some other infotech stuff, because that's what you're studying at Harvard, and it's a longstanding interest of mine. Before we go into overtime, anything else you want to say about this subject? And also, why don't we do this part first? Where can people find your stuff? Are you active on Twitter or any other social media?
I'm on Twitter. I try to post less these days, but I'm TianYuf on Twitter. You know, now that I'm in academia, I try to write an essay or two every year. That's where to find me.
And if people want to see various things you've written, they could go to your website.
My website. Yep.
TianYuFang.net. So good. And then, now the question of, is there anything else you want to say? I mean, actually, there's a... Well, you can say whatever you want to say. I'm also interested in in just asking you, like, what is the most common, you think, misconception in America about China? If there's one you can articulate. If not, skip it. Or just a commonly encountered misconception, or something you have to explain. Maybe just a commonly asked question.
I mean, this doesn't seem like a misconception, but you know, it's a pretty big country, right? Like, one example I always give is that I think it is easier to get away with things in China than it is to to get away with things in Singapore. Both countries have pretty drastic forms of social and political control. But Singapore is a much smaller country. You're much easier to get caught, and there's probably somebody being in charge of your case if you say something wrong. And China is just much bigger. It's a much bigger country. You have more bureaucrats, but you also don't have enough bureaucrats. The government is very messy. There's a lot of unevenness to the things that you do. Sometimes you see news stories about this one thing happened in China. Like, yeah, it's a country of 1.4 billion people. And just because that one thing happened doesn't mean it is happening to everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same way that, like, we see some crazy state senator from Louisiana saying something doesn't mean that everybody in America thinks that, right? So
right.
I think it's some very important, the matter of scale really matters when it comes to thinking about things in China.
Okay. Anything else you want to say before we go into overtime?
No, I'm happy to go to overtime.
All right. So thanks, everybody who stayed with us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.